Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Nathan Calmo, who is the author of With Ballots and Bullets, Partisanship and Violence in the American Civil War. This was published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press, and it is a deep and complex dive into thinking about partisanship and violence, particularly as Nathan has explored it in the Civil War. But I'm going to let him talk a lot more about that. I'd like to welcome Nathan to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how you came to this particular project.
Thank you, Lily. So I'm a associate professor of political communication at Louisiana State University. And I mostly study things that aren't historical. Most of my work is on public opinion and communication effects in contemporary politics, surveys and experiments. But this one is a little bit different. In grad school, I had a friend who was really interested in 19th century political history and the Civil War era in particular. And he and I got to talking and he got me excited about learning more about that really fascinating period, really turbulent and traumatic period of American history. And long story short, I was reading so much about Civil War history that that wasn't part of finishing my dissertation, that I wanted to think about ways that I could take this new topic that I was really passionate about and work it into my budding expertise, I guess, in understanding mass political behavior. And the first directions I thought about were about how casualties might affect voting, and that's something that eventually ended up in the book as well. In grad school, I had to put a pin in that and just sit on it because most of the data that I needed to do the project was just not available. Fast forward a couple of years, I was a postdoc at George Washington University. And as I was finishing up there, I happened to come across data that was digitized of over a million Union Civil War soldiers, individual level data on where they were from, when they enlisted, when they left the service, whether they were killed or deserted or just ended their time of service. And with that data, I was able to think much more expansively about this project, and it all kind of came together. Very briefly, the gist of the book is thinking about how ordinary partisans were mobilized into mass violence in the Civil War. And then the latter half of the book, thinking about how that violence fed back into the political system and changed how people were voting during and after the war, and then also how partisan shaped the memory of the war in the decades after it.
And in reading your book, I was constantly drawn back to our contemporary political environment in the post January 6th. Sort of experience as well in terms of partisanship and the connection partisanship to violence, particularly among partisan elites, which is a lot of what you talk about. But since you made that beautiful statement about what the book's actually about, but I wanted to take you through how you got at the data and what the data is that sort of makes up this book, because it's really interesting. You kind of like have layers in a tapestry. And as I was reading it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like all kinds of different data sets and quantitative and qualitative. So you have newspapers, census data, soldiers' records, and election returns, right? I think those are the four groups.
Those are the main things. And then some supplementary stuff with monumentation in the post-war era, which states adopted what became Memorial Day sooner or later. But the main data are the ones that you described, the core of the book.
And so, you know, when we think about census data, obviously we're just after a census year, we count where the Americans are and other people are in the country. And you took census data. Also, you sort of were able to map onto it sort of partisanship through the election returns. Can you explain a little bit about, again, how you sort of conceived of this project? Because I was fascinated by all the pieces in it.
Thank you. Yeah, the big picture is that this is a big methodological divergence from what I'm normally doing. If I had my druthers, I would have had a survey or an experiment in order to do a more conventional approach. But of course, those methods are not available going back 160 years. And so instead, I had to think with what are called ecological methods, thinking about how the characteristics of places rather than individuals. The part of the big picture story is that because I didn't have the usual survey and experimental tools that I use, I had to bring in a much wider range of types of data in order to tell the story persuasively. You could do a contemporary public opinion survey and nail down a lot of the questions people have about the relationships that you're describing. You couldn't do that with the kind of data that I had. So I needed to take the individual level survey data, identify where people were from, and merge them into the counties that they were from, essentially, using the census data based on where they were from, bring in other census information for demographics and to know populations to develop estimates of the proportions of people for each category, bringing in county level elections data. So most of the analysis, but not all, is at the county level. And then bringing in the newspapers as a content analysis, not directly integrated into the data set, but as a supplement to understand what the partisan rhetoric of the war sounded like.
So in terms of the data sets that you were using and sort of grafting on information to other information that you were sort of piecing together like this giant jigsaw puzzle, you were talking about the role of newspapers. And as we know, the newspapers at the time were kind of partisan. There were partisan press newspapers on various sides. Can you explain a little bit about how you used the newspaper and the rhetoric of the time to help you understand like election returns and the soldiers' records?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you say, most of the news at that time was affiliated with one party. It wasn't just that that one party was supported more by one side or the other. It was that in many cases, the newspaper was being bankrolled by the party or by prominent people in the party, that the editors of those newspapers were often major figures influencing party nominations and other party organization issues. So I'm thinking about the newspapers as a couple of different things. On the one hand, they are a measure of partisan elite opinion about the war, or at least the public expressions that they're using strategically to accomplish their purposes. So in that sense, it's a gauge of that. A broader model of mass politics that I'm drawing heavily on is the idea of opinion leadership, that people often can't make sense of the complications of politics. And so they turn to people who they trust in their communities and among leaders who they trust for signals about how to think and how to act in politics. And so in addition to measuring what party leaders are saying about the war, this is clearly public communication to partisans and undecided people in the public that is potentially influencing those who are paying attention. And it's a broader measure of what sort of the core of the party is thinking that's going to be diffused more generally as people have conversations with each other, even when they're not reading those newspapers. And by the way, literacy rates were quite high. So a lot of people were exposed to that content. And most cities of any size had both a Democratic and a Republican newspaper, even when one party was far more dominant in that area.
And so you have the various pieces, as you say, you had to sort of dive into them and sort of sew them together and bring them together to some degree to get them to speak to each other and to figure out what was going on in terms of how, as you say, ordinary partisans were mobilized towards violence, and also how the violence fed back into, the sort of partisans and the citizens in general. And of course, this is the Civil War. The as you note, with all the historical sort of numbers, the worst experience the United States has had in a war, in terms of dead and so forth of the population. And so, you know, we know the broad contours of the war, but you're trying to get at this sort of connection between the partisanship, like how you are in a party and who your party is and how that connected to the actual fighting of the war and acceptance of the war. How did you sort of get into that zone, and what did you find?
Yeah, the context of the war first is that you have its proximate cause is the election of Abraham Lincoln as the first Republican president, and the claims of secession of refusing to accept the result of that presidential election by predominantly Southern Democrats. It has that partisan origin. Of course, the major divides between the two parties at that time were over the issue of the expansion of Black enslavement into the West. So that's I'm not claiming that the war was about party rather than slavery. It was that the parties were divided over that. In that context, the expectation in this book was that Republicans were going to be in the public were going to be relatively more willing to fight to defend the election result to maintain the legitimacy of Lincoln's election compared to Democrats. The interesting dynamic by focusing just on partisanship within the North is that I'm also able to track variation in support for the war among Democrats at the elite level and see how that within the newspapers is likewise reflected in the enlistment rates of people from more Republican or more Democratic places in counties across the North. So you have at the beginning of the war, you have Democrats kind of lukewarm to leaning in support, led by Stephen Douglas, for instance, who was one of the defeated Democratic candidates of two. He was a Northern Democratic candidate, and there was a Southern Democratic candidate in that election. And as you got to the 1862 election, the midterm election, Democrats were at the elite level were relatively pro-war in their statements. And then after that election, you have them moving massively against the war. So that by the time you get to the 1864 presidential election, Lincoln's re-election, every Democratic newspaper that I looked at in my sample of it was a relatively representative sample of newspapers was saying at least slightly, if not vehemently, anti-war sentiments. And that shift in positions over the war within the Northern parties is reflected not just in an average greater enlistment rate of Republican individuals and people from Republican predominant areas. But you also see a dynamic change over time, that when the gap between the partisan newspapers was largest is when you see the largest gap in Republican areas contributing a much larger share of their military age men to fight. And in addition to that, that basic mobilization into violence and how that shifted dynamically over time, I also find that desertion rates, even just among people who have enlisted, are also different based on whether they people come from a more Republican or more Democratic place. So even after the selection effect of into enlistment, you still see additional effects while people are in service. And then these differences also led to differences in casualty rates from Republican places, losing a larger share of their men as well.
And in reading that, the part that I kept thinking about is that the Republicans are sort of acting like classical Republicans in Roman times, that the commitment to the state was quite substantial and sort of ongoing. And that was what I was seeing in your research, that I was also sort of surprised because I assumed it would kind of be equal.
Certainly they had partisan motives to support Lincoln's election. But there could be an ideological angle to that as well, for sure, particularly among the political leadership class.
And one of the points that you make in sort of talking not only about like who was fighting the war and how they were disposed towards the war at the elite level and at the sort of soldier citizen level, you also talk about sort of the narrative about the 1864 presidential election. And for somebody who studies narratives in popular culture, and you look at narratives in terms of communication and rhetoric, what is the narrative about the 1864 election, particularly with regard to Atlanta? And what did you find that kind of maybe disproved it?
Yeah, so most of the accounts of public opinion during the Civil War, both from contemporaries who are writing and from historians looking back on that time, talk about a really a roller coaster of emotions in how the public is responding to victories and losses and changes in war policy. Not just changes in how people are feeling, but also a presumption that those changes in mood are changing how people are voting, that when things are going well for the Union, that Union voters are going to support the Republican incumbent administration, and that when things are not going so well for the Union cause, that they're going to abandon the Republican Party, and in doing so, potentially abandon fighting the war by the end when the Democratic Party is largely anti-war. The centerpiece of this narrative is about the 1864 presidential election, in which even Lincoln himself thought he was essentially doomed to lose his reelection effort because of how badly things were going in the summer of 1864. And some Republicans were actually trying to knock him off of the ballot to replace him because they thought his chances were so low. They were basically ready to do a Hail Mary to try to salvage the election for themselves. They assumed that they needed some major war progress in order to shore up support and avoid certain defeat. The armies of General Sherman successfully capture Atlanta around the beginning of September of 1864. And the story goes, Lincoln's reelection was guaranteed from that point. So it's basically this a narrative that we're familiar with in contemporary elections of what we call game changers, except this would be the largest game changer that you can imagine with existential implications for the fate of the country. What I find is, first of all, I I find that there's a very strong relationship between votes for president and votes for House and for governor, partisan voting. That's not surprising when you think about our current electoral environment, but there is a line of research in history that says the local parties were almost completely distinct from the same party in other places. And so you might expect there not to be a strong relationship. Long story short, you can use those partisan votes that are staggered throughout the 4 years of the war as a kind of national partisan barometer for how the public is feeling about Republicans. And what you see in that barometer is a almost shocking amount of stability in partisan vote share, with a minor exception I'm happy to talk more about. But essentially, stability. Lincoln is essentially on track for re-election for most of his presidency, and Republicans in Congress and in governorships along with him. So you see basically no responsiveness to any number of events or to accumulating national casualties, basically just a stable vote share. I have to include caveats that, for instance, there weren't a lot of votes that were in the middle of that summer. So we just have a couple of states that voted before that time and, early 1864 in the winter and spring, and then states voting from September through November. But the overall picture there is of stability in partisan vote share that doesn't support the idea that the public was volatile. They may have been volatile in their moods, in their reactions in that respect, but they don't seem to be volatile in respect to their voting patterns.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
But you did say there was one exception.
Yeah. The one exception is the fall of 1862. That sounds like a bigger exception than it is. Because that was midterm elections, and you might think, well, those were all of the elections. The thing that's really interesting about voting in this era is that you didn't have all of the states voting for Congress at the same time. There was basically an election season that was longer than a year, where votes were staggered. I think there was at least one vote for Congress in half of the months of the war. So rather than just having one period in between Lincoln's two elections, you have dozens of months that have votes. So the one exception is a handful of states voting in October and November of 1862. You see a drop in Republican vote shares of roughly somewhere between 5 or 10%, depending on exactly how you measure it. And that's literally the only drop. Every other set of months during the war, it's dead on with Lincoln's vote share in those states. So there's lots of reasons why people have noticed that Republicans lost seats in those elections. So this isn't a startling finding, but most of the accounts of why they lost seats in those places, there's a whole range of discussions, some which are focused on, well, yeah, they won the Battle of Antietam, but then they lost a couple of small battles after, so that got rid of the victory bump that would have happened if not for those other things. Or some focus on Lincoln's preliminary Emancipation Proclamation that came out immediately after the Union victory at Antietam, which basically said in 3 months, if the Southern states that are still fighting are continuing their rebellion, then all enslaved people in those states are going to be freed as soon as the Union armies can get to them. That argument was saying that a bunch of racist white voters really reacted negatively to that change in war aims. But some of the places that lost the biggest vote share are, for instance, Massachusetts, which was known as a bastion of relatively, at least, of anti-slavery sentiment. And so a number of other suggestions on what could have caused that change, none of the accounts seem to fit the data very well. And so actually, it's a little bit frustrating, but in the book, I kind of throw up my hands. I say, I checked out these three or four things. None of them seem to be right. And I don't have an answer. So
so it's just the president's party loses votes in the off-year election, basically.
Yes. So there's that cyclical element. And that's very common throughout basically all election centuries. But you'd think that would also apply to the votes in early 1862, that they would apply in the early 1863 votes. And you don't see that there. So I don't know why you would have a midterm loss that only applies in that fall voting season, because the other votes months before and months after seem just as much like midterms, at least to my eye. So I don't know what the story is.
All right, I won't ask you any more questions about it. We'll just leave it at that.
Somebody else can figure that out.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask you also, in sort of thinking about the work that you did in this book, which is really historical, but it's also really social science-y. So you were bringing together kind of these two sides of separate disciplines. And you also, you talk a lot about the historian's interpretations of particular periods of time and events. Can you explain a little bit about how you were sort of negotiating these two disciplines, talking about the same kind of events?
Yeah. Throughout the project, I wanted to be really careful to fully respect the work that historians have done. I'm basically standing on their shoulders as much as I'm standing on the shoulders of political scientists in doing this. The Civil War experience is interesting in its own right because of how absolutely pivotal and impactful it was for the development of the country. So understanding it as a historical event in its own right is extremely valuable, but it's also a period. This is where the sort of the mass political behavior social science part comes in. It's a period of extremes that falls well outside what most of the context that we have studied American political behavior, at least in sort of the contemporary methods, has been. And so it's, in addition to being historically important in its own right, it's also about as far out as you can go in terms of extreme partisan context to essentially test how ordinary people respond in those circumstances. And even though most people didn't think about their participation in the war and didn't talk about their participation in the war as I'm a good Republican and so I'm going to go fight to put down the rebellion, you see these enormous partisan differences when the Republican leaders who they trust are telling them you need to enlist to support and uphold the country and the Constitution. And that leads to this partisan difference. We usually think about political violence as like a few extremists. And at least when we think of it in the contemporary American context, but if you look at the American historical context or when you look at cross-national cases, you've got mass violence. My goal here was to see how ordinary partisans respond to those party cues. And it looks like ordinary people being mobilized into killing and dying based on their partisan mobilization.
So in terms of discussing the political violence, the mass political violence that we see in the Civil War, which is a war, and as you are talking about it in the book, about how that connected people with regard to their partisan dispositions and their partisanship, what do we understand about how those things work together in this particular context, in this very volatile period in the U.S. history?
Yeah, I think the main takeaways are that people have individual motivations to feel extreme attitudes about politics, but that going from attitudes that are supporting violence to actually engaging in violence is a really big step for a lot of reasons. And if we look at people who study violence in a cross-national context, they point to the importance of not just group leaders, but also group norms that are built up and reinforced, but also sometimes change. And direct advocacy of leaders calling for violence, and also changing conceptions of what good group members do when those start to include violence, being willing to die for your group, that changes the calculus of how people make individual decisions. And even the boring bureaucratic structure of one of the mechanisms, I think, in the Civil War context is that you have local partisan leaders who are just creating opportunities for people to enlist in the war by holding rallies in addition to the rhetoric that they are giving that's calling on their citizens to join the fight, that they're just giving them the opportunity, and that these are public meetings where in many cases people are expected to stand up in front of their neighbors and go enlist. So you've got these incredible social pressures on people as well. So the book is not just about the individual psychology of partisanship. It's also about how people are responding to their partisan friends and neighbors and how they're responding to party leaders as well. So all of those aspects are important for thinking about how you get from having really extreme reactions to politics to actually carrying out extreme actions in the form of violence.
And one of the points that you make in the book, also in the second half of the book, is what happens afterwards, and how some of the sort of inclinations of partisanship and this violence is sort of transformed into monuments and the kind of honors that are given to the fallen soldiers and the establishment of Decoration Day that becomes Memorial Day. Can you explain a little bit about that particular interesting transition for both sides of the partisan coin?
Yeah, so you have, even before the war ends, you have, of course, people responding to this mass death. You have, if you include the Southerners as well as Northerners who died in the war. You have 750,000 Americans who are dead over the course of 4 years, which would be roughly 8 million per capita if you translated it into today's population. So you have a huge social and emotional upheaval of large numbers of men in the community leaving and never coming back. That first had effects on how people were voting during the war. And then after the war, it had effects on how they remembered the war. As Democrats at the leadership level turned against the war, they increasingly cast those dead as senseless losses to essentially a hopeless cause that is being pushed by Republicans who only want to create racial equality, which was seen as a major wedge issue at that time. And on the other hand, Republicans were casting these deaths as martyrdoms, as this is in many cases a righteous cause, both secularly and religiously, a righteous cause, and the deaths are reasons why we should continue the fight, and that you should continue to support the Republican administration. And the result of those competing narratives is that in the Republican places, they were able to maintain their support for the war, even as the casualties mounted. In places that were predominantly Democratic, where those messages of senseless loss were predominant, they were able to persuade a handful of percent of people to move against the Republican Party. Places that weren't necessarily electing Republicans to begin with, but they moved even further in terms of their total vote shares against. Those same kinds of patterns continued with war memory after. Republicans didn't want to give up this, what they saw as their noble service, rightly so, and wanted to commemorate it. The bureaucracy, the record keeping is better in the Republican states. They wanted to document not just in terms of monuments, not just in terms of holidays, but even the quality of the records that they kept about the individuals who participated. They wanted to both honor their service and their sacrifice, and also to be able to administer pensions better for those who participated. And so they kept better records in addition to these symbolic differences in how they remembered the war. So they were more likely to put up monuments. They were more likely to recognize Decoration Day as a state holiday at an earlier time. And the casualty effects that you see during the war, where Democratic places moved against Republicans when they had higher levels of casualties, that persists in post-war elections through Reconstruction, which is really really shocking, but also understandable given the scope, the magnitude of mass death.
And one of the things that I also found fascinating, and this is a kind of sidebar question or comment, is that you dedicated the book to relatives of yours who fought in the war. And you're very clear about it, and you talk also about it in the preface and the acknowledgments. I was just curious a bit. I mean, I assume you knew about them before you started working on this book, but I wonder if they were in your mind so much of the time as you were writing this.
That's right. Two great grandfathers who fought for the U.S. Army. One is Ole Roxvold, who is a corporal in the 12th Iowa Infantry Regiment, and Charles Brown, who is a private in the 8th Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry Regiment. When I first started learning about the Civil War in grad school, I at the same time, my mom was starting to get into genealogy research, and I realized that a number of our ancestors had arrived from Norway mostly before the Civil War. So it made me wonder, I wonder if I have a local connection to this era that I'm reading about. And it turned out that I had these two relatives. Both survived. One was wounded and was a prisoner of war for the better part of a year. But they made it through, which is why I'm here, because they hadn't had kids before that point. It changed how I thought about the war, in part because it gave me focal points to not just read about the macro histories, but also many regiments after the war produced regimental histories, mostly self-promoting, just celebrating their legitimately heroic deeds, and also, puffing up their role that they played in particular moments a little bit as well. And so in addition to thinking about the macro politics of the era and thinking about the violence of the era, also being able to trace these individual stories, not in the narrative of the book, but just on a personal level to think about, and I've actually visited most of the places that they went during their times in the South. I'm actually, one of them was wounded in Louisiana. And now the state of Louisiana is my employer. So I think there's something satisfying about that.
And so my final question for you today, Nathan, is what is it that you're working on now?
Yeah, so I said at the beginning that historical analysis isn't what I have normally focused on, and how I wish there were surveys and experiments in the Civil War era. I just finished a book with Dr. Lily Mason that looks at contemporary violent partisan attitudes and a little bit on aggressive political behaviors as well, tracking since 2017, in over a dozen surveys, the levels of not just extreme hostility, but also support for violence among Republicans and Democrats in our politics today, looking at the kinds of people who endorse those positions, how those have changed over the last couple of years, which might not surprise you that those trends have gone up. How people conceptualize when violence is appropriate. Most people aren't entirely pacifists when it comes to political violence. They endorse the American Revolution, for instance, maybe not surprisingly. And then thinking about interventions, both interventions that are out of people's control to a certain extent, how people react to elections and political violence, events that are violent, and how leaders' rhetoric can change how people are thinking about these, both in inflaming ways and in pacifying ways. And one of the most remarkable things that we find, I think, is that in experiments with rhetoric, both from Biden and from Trump, we find that when they very explicitly denounce violence and describe it as completely inappropriate for our politics, using real quotes from them, people are less willing to endorse partisan violence in those cases. So in Trump's case, we had to use a quote from a White House statement, something that he never said publicly out loud, but nonetheless, we were able to use a real quote that is attributed to him that was pacifying. So a long story short, next year, early 2022, that book will be out. In some ways, it's certainly thematically very much a continuation of the interests that are on display in this book on the Civil War partisanship and violence.
Yeah, and I would love to talk to you and Lily when the book comes out to sort of have the next part of the story, as it were.
That would be wonderful.
So I wanted to thank you, Nathan Calmo, for talking to me today about With Ballots and Bullets, Partisanship and Violence in the American Civil War, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. Any local brick and mortar stores with an online presence that you would like to give a shout out to?
You put me on the spot. I'm going to pass.
Okay, that's fine. We'll just send people to the Cambridge University Press website to buy a copy of this really fascinating and complex analysis of violence and partisanship in the United States. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Lily. It was wonderful.